Daniel Morris Salter served for 20 years as an electronic communications expert with the US Air Force. He reached the rank of E9 Command Sergeant Major before he was recruited into the top secret National Reconnaissance Office, where he got to work on projects concerning UFOs and extraterrestrial life. And today we have with us his two grandsons, Daniel and Derek, who are going to tell us about records that they've been able to retrieve from the National Archives confirming Daniel Salter's career in the Air Force, his clearances, and they're going to be talking about some of the information he revealed in his book and his testimonies concerning UFOs and extraterrestrial life.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Well, welcome, Daniel and Derek, to Exopolitics Today. Great to have you back.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Sala.
Well, there might be some people who didn't see our first interview and maybe want to know a little bit about you and how you got interested in pursuing your grandfather's story. So, yeah, tell us how you got interested in doing that.
So our grandfather's career, he was 20 years in the Air Force and several years in the NRO after that. He started in the Air Force in the late 40s and the NRO in the late 60s. And when he retired, he started talking about UFOs, extraterrestrials, and his experiences with various clearances he had there. And he was part of Dr. Greer's Disclosure Project, which is the first time we really fully understood the depth of his knowledge. And then he came out with his book, Life with Us Cosmos Clearance, in 2003. And that really got us even further down the rabbit hole of what he actually was involved with and what he knew. As we were growing up as teenagers, the 90s, he would sometimes mention things about UFOs, and he disclosed a few things to me and to Derek as well. Just some of his personal information he had, some of his experiences. He showed me a couple videos he had of different things dealing with UFO topic and aliens. So at the time, I wasn't really 100% certain on how to take that because I'd never heard anyone talk about that stuff. But he would always say, you know, this is the truth. And so I always had in the back of my mind that maybe there's something to this. I never really talked about it with other people publicly until his book came out. And that really shed a lot of light, like I said. And since then, the past 20 years, Derek and I have been diving into the disclosure movement and trying to understand more sources that corroborate our grandfather's information. And we've been very successful along the way so far. So it's kind of an exciting journey for us to deep dive on his history and what he had going on.
Anything you want to add to that, Derek?
Yeah, my experience is pretty much very similar to my brother's. I think my brother's 4 years older than me, so he had probably a little bit more actual knowledge sharing that our grandfather tried to relay to him. I think by the time I was old enough, he sort of kind of didn't express as much as he used to, and he expressed a lot too. Of course, our father, my mother, which is his daughter. And so they got a lot of, you know, one-on-one type of conversations and just kind of off the cuff, hey, by the way, these aliens exist, or I've dealt with this in whatever capacity, but it was hard to really believe that. And then once he was part of the Disclosure Project, he was already declining in health. Both, you know, he had a mini stroke, so both his mental capacity and even physically, he was starting to deteriorate pretty fast. So that made us question even more what he had to say and how much we could believe. But the fact that Dr. Greer, you know, he must have vetted him out along with all the other whistleblowers that were coming out. And so him even being a part of the 20-some that went to D.C. in 2001 seemed pretty significant to tell us that he must have had some kind of access and clearance and backing up what he was testifying about and what he came out with within his book in 2003. So it just led us on this search after that. And we've really tried to really dedicate ourselves to connecting the dots and picking up the pieces where he might have left off, and including all the books that he read and I'm continuing to read and put the pieces together where they fit. And the more we research, the more we hear that's coming out in the mainstream, the more it validates what he had to say.
And I just add to that to further clarify, by the time that his book came out in 2003, his health had deteriorated quite a bit, his mental capacity. And so we weren't able to talk to him about it or learn more from him at that time once we knew the information that he wanted to get out there. So it was unfortunate the timing of all that. So that's why we're kind of, you know, on our journey to dive deeper and figure out what really happened. And so.
So in our first interview on, you know, that's the banner, and you can find it on Exopolitics Today. What you presented were some of the documents that you found in the personal effects of your grandfather. And so we went over some of those documents. But since then, you applied to the National Archives for documentation, further documentation. So, yeah, just explain, you know, why you went to the National Archives and what they gave you.
Yeah, I was actually able to kind of finally get some answers back after requesting this. And Dr. Sala, I think it was probably shortly after we spoke, and I was really curious your take on what our grandfather had to say in the book. And he said, well, you know, you basically said that there's a lot you can, you know, actually request now and should be able to find out if you do that, if you're obviously related and you can get those records. So it was possible for us to finally get some answers. It took over a year before they did respond. And they had kind of just said nothing. So I just didn't assume we wouldn't get anything back. And eventually, you know, they came back with just over 100 pages of his military records. And a lot of that, it was great because it showed the cryptographic clearance he had, the top secret clearance he had, other clearances before earlier on in his career. So a lot of things came to light getting those records, and we were able to pass them on to you, of course, so that you could also have a look yourselves. But and there's still a lot that we're still trying to uncover and go meticulously through each one, but it's revealed a lot so far.
Well, the records you did get, I mean, they do document and they do show that he achieved a very high rank in the Air Force and had very senior responsibilities. So I thought I'd get your comments on some of the documents. So let's start off with the statement of service document that shows his 20-year career in the Air Force. And, you know, I mean, there you have documentary proof that Daniel Salter worked with the U.S. Air Force for 20 years. So what do you want to say about this particular document?
So this kind of shows how, you know, after a certain service, when his duty time was up, he had to re-enlist and continue that on. The first stint was 3 years, and after that, it seems to be in six-year increments through his career. And the last re-enlistment was in August of 67. And there's actually another document in that package that talks about, you know, them signing off on, it was like a process to validate that after 20 years of in the Air Force, he was eligible or a candidate to further pursue his career or something. So it seemed to be like some sort of process to get that last enlistment period in reactivated. But what I found interesting, there's other documents showing when he retired, and he filed for his retirement in November of 67, which was 3 months after he reenlisted for the second time going through that process. And he requested to be retired on May 1st of 1968, even though he still had his current enlistment didn't expire until 1971. So I feel like his retirement maybe was not necessarily planned if he, you know, kind of did that 3 months after reenlisting for another 6 years. So from what I gathered from that, that's the time that he became an NRO operative. So I'm thinking maybe that's when he was contacted and recruited. And maybe that initially was not a part of his plan. So I found that pretty interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense, that after serving 20 years, achieving that very senior rank as an enlisted officer, that he gets recruited, and it was because of his specialty. So there's another document which is, it shows that he was the chief of the program section as a command master sergeant. So yeah, you want to talk about this document, because again, this confirms that he had achieved a very senior rank and also responsibilities.
Yes, I mean, from this document, and there are similar documents that talk about the different periods in his career and the different positions he held, and what his credentials were, and what how his performance was. And he seemed to be kind of managing teams. He started with radar technology and electronics and communication, but he definitely became he accelerated quickly up through the ranks in his career, responsible for creating a lot of different programs for different procedures and things like that, enhancing various programs within the Air Force and through the technologies. It was what I discovered is he was much more technically capable of a lot of stuff than I was aware of before. I didn't know he was kind of an expert in those, some of those realms. But reading this, it seems that he was very capable in that capacity, and it really accelerated his career as a leader too, and as a manager.
And he mentioned, and you've been able to confirm through the documentation, that he had all of these different clearance levels. And so he's the chief of the program section in the US Air Force, doing all kinds of work with nuclear installations, electronic communications. So you could understand why someone like him would be of great interest to the National Reconnaissance Office, that would recruit people like that who are very senior at the kind of end of that 20 years, ready to move on to something else.
Yeah. Yes, we have one of the documents, I don't know if you have it, was a documentation of his crypto clearance that he initially had. And in that documentation also, it talks about his secret clearance that was established in 1953. I think that was the first, you know, level, you know, before there's classified, secret, top secret, and then there's all the other levels that, you know, that aren't publicly disclosed. He claimed to be at 38 levels above top secret as a Cosmos clearance, which is the name of his book. But we have the documentation of when he first got a secret security clearance. So then it said it's based on various projects that he was assigned to officially and duties he had to carry through. So that was early in his career. So I can imagine over the 20-year span, he definitely progressed and learned more and gained more access to various programs.
So at the end of 20 years in the US Air Force, and you already commented about this kind of period where he re-enlisted, and 3 months later, he's retiring, but that seems to be really a cover for him moving into the National Reconnaissance Office. And there's a document, his selective re-enlistment document, and again, this is one of those images. So this is one of those documents that you found from the National Archives. So, you know, what is the significance of this document? Because it seems to show that 20 years is like a threshold in the military, where unless you have the kind of right abilities and the kind of experience, you're kind of like subject to some kind of mandatory retirement. And if you have achieved those that kind of experience and whatever levels they require, then you're ready to move on, to continue on the military. So, yeah, this selective reenlistment document, that seems interesting to me. Do you want to comment about it?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was alluding to before. You know, you have to have the commander endorsed your credibility to go beyond that you're to the caliber of the person that they're ready to follow through on the 20 plus years. So it seems like that was an interesting document for sure, that he was chosen for that and recommended for that, and that he was really pursuing that, because it doesn't seem like it's just the standard reenlistment process like the other ones may have been, you know.
Right, so this is documentation that supports what he said, that after his 20 years with the Air Force, he was then recruited into the NRO. Because, you know, to be clear here, what the National Archives gave you was military records pertinent to his 20 years with the Air Force. They didn't give you anything pertaining to his NRO, because that obviously is like at a very high classification level, and that still hasn't been released to you. Right. But this document, I think, proves that he did do something after retirement.
Yeah, and Derek, I believe you did request from the NRO any documentation, and they said they had no record, right? But I think when you start out at that clearance level that he already had, there probably isn't going to be any record, you know, going into it at that higher level, I would imagine.
The way they framed it seemed a little, or the way they phrased it seemed a little strange to me, as if it was a kind of way to go around avoiding, you know, what was any direct involvement, if it was, you know, direct or whatever. But I think there's evidence that we can tell that he was involved in some capacity, but we just haven't gotten anything official yet. Yeah.
Yes, and that's a very interesting question. How does organizations like the NRO, how do they deal with kind of records of former personnel? They probably file them away, or maybe hand them over to some corporation to look after them. So when someone submits a FOIA request, they can reply and say, you know, without any kind of legal problems, that they can say, well, we have no records pertinent to your request in our files. And that's true, because they've all been moved over, whether it's to the CIA or whether it's with some corporation that's set up to administer all the records. I mean, these guys are very good at manipulating the system to hide their records.
Absolutely. No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's probably lies within some other organization, so they don't have to be held accountable for it. Yeah.
Well, there's another document that I thought was interesting, and this is the Marksmanship Expert Ribbon. And I thought that was interesting because your grandfather did say that he was involved in the enforcement side of the secrecy system. In other words, that there would be these teams that would go to witnesses, whistleblowers, anyone that was threatening to blow the whistle or to reveal the truth of what's going on with UFOs. And your grandfather was part of those teams. And so here's a record showing that he was an expert marksman. So, yeah, you want to comment about that and how this pertained to what he was saying about his career within the NRO?
Yeah, and I can just comment that basically he claimed to be a part of the original Project Blue Book. And I think there's enough people, enough about that out there now that people know that in particular, that it was sort of the official way for the government to acknowledge that there's UFO activity. And how do we figure out, okay, where is it coming from? Let's do the research and even try to debunk it or figure out what is it. And I think it really was a campaign to more or less debunk most of the sightings. So that's what J. Allen Hynek's job was. And our grandfather basically said what Hynek was doing in the public view is what he had to do in a military capacity to the military, not on the civilian side, but to the military families and those that saw something. He'd be one of the first in those groups of whatever teams that would come and say, okay, you didn't see what you think you saw. This could be swamp gas. This could be other means, other sorts of sighting type of whatever account it might have been, to try to just throw them off or discredit them and just say, you know, you're not going to want to, you know, talk further about this. This is just kind of something you should just, you know, keep quiet about. And it was more or less non-threatening what he was doing, but there was teams after him. There was another team he said that would come in and be a little bit more verbal upfront and say, hey, you know, you better keep quiet, or we're going to have to go to other means, you know, and threaten and even make threats to the family and everything else in their careers. And then there was a third team, which he plainly said that you basically would eliminate people, terminate people for trying to come out with this information. So that goes back to the Men in Black topic as well. And that's kind of what in and the disclosure world and the capacity of what they were doing, trying to keep. I saw obviously one file off these was about Area 51, trying to keep that under wraps, but keep anybody trying to get this information out from talking. And he talks about the different names they had, the 00 boys, the Wackenut assassins, and these terms for these individuals.
And I mean, I don't know what his thoughts were when he put the information in the book, but if he was, you know, this marksman and he was trained for, in that area for a specific reason, maybe he might not want to admit that he was, you know, potentially on the docket to potentially make the threats or further than that. He claimed he was just on the first level where they, the first stage of persuasion, we'll say, to discredit, you know, the phenomena that people saw.
Well, one of the things I know about these covert teams is that even though he may have been part of that first team, they're still trained to do additional functions so that if there was a gap that needed to be filled, that he could, like, if the third team said, "Oh, we need someone to help us out," you know, so and so is kind of like on vacation, and that we need someone, and so that could happen.
When you think about at the time, the pool of people that have that knowledge that are parts of these programs was probably relatively small, starting in the 50s, as far as, you know, getting these Blue Books projects started, and you know. So there's not going to be a lot of people in the know with the right clearances to be involved in that. So they probably had to rely on others as backups.
Yeah, definitely. So those are the documents from the National Archives that got my attention. Are there any others that you thought are kind of very pertinent to what your grandfather told you?
I was just looking through and I just saw some interesting ones. As I mentioned, it's the clearance documents. I found one where he was in various campaigns in Korea and in China, and there was one about a crypto project that I'm not entirely sure what it entailed, but
it gave him access to a bunch of different bases, you said, right? Or different.
He was efficiently monitored the extremely sensitive KW7 online crypto installations at 31 Air Division sites. So I'm not sure, you know, what that is, but it's where I've seen it mentioned, you know, that we talk about his crypto clearance and what he was involved in. So I thought that was interesting. That's just one that I came across just recently, but like Derek said, there's hundreds of pages here that we need to further investigate for sure.
I don't know, Dr. Sala, the very first one I had shared, was that cryptographic access certificate. And that reads as out of the types of clearances, whether it's confidential, secret, or top secret, it did state it's top secret and had his, had him sign it off from December 66. And then when you sign once you're finished your term with that clearance, and it was April of 68.
Thank you.
The other document.
Yeah, and talking with Dan Willis, you know, he also had a cryptographic clearance, and that, you know, definitely exposed him to a lot of things that most people didn't see just with that level. So I can only imagine, you know, after 20 years with that, or, you know, going up the ranks with these clearances, you know, where he was at and what he knew.
Yeah, it's very interesting you mentioned Dan Willis, because I remember talking to him and he said he still can't talk about some of the things he saw where he had crypto clearance to that still illegal, even though those happened like 30 years ago. Yep. So he finishes his Air Force career in 67. He's moved over to the NRO. He's got all these clearances, crypto clearance. He's now doing a lot of things relating to the UFO crash retrieval programs and dealing with extraterrestrial life. One of the people that I guess one of the people that were part of the Disclosure Project that he knew or at least got to meet at the Disclosure Project was Clifford Stone. I think we have you sent me an image of him and Clifford together. And Clifford Stone is very interesting. He served for 22 years in the Army, and he was called away on temporary duty to the Air Force to perform these covert missions. So there you have the two of them together. So what did your grandfather tell you about Clifford Stone and what he knew of him and and his experiences.
Yeah, Dan, did you want to? Not that I'm aware of that he said, you know, personal experiences he had with him, but he mentions him in the book as one of the main whistleblowers from 2001 and the importance of his testimony and the different races that he had claimed to know, at least 57, I believe he said. But that's the picture of him sitting behind Clifford Stone at the Disclosure Project during the press club hearing when the reporters are asking the questions to Clifford Stone. So.
Yeah, and so I don't know if he knew Clifford Stone prior to the Disclosure Project, but I'm sure, you know, a lot of those guys talked a lot. We've heard Dan Willis talk about, you know, they, you know, collaborated and shared information quite a bit during that time that they were there for the 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, Dan Willis said he had breakfast with my grandfather. He remembers having breakfast with him and talking with him. So.
Okay, yeah, it's very interesting that whistleblowers, really, I mean, that's what we can call them, that they got to meet each other and establish communications and find out what each was doing, but that they might not have known each other beforehand due to the compartmentalization process.
Absolutely, yeah. And as they come forward, I think it's very interesting how they all have different pieces of a puzzle, and probably the first time they're all seeing the other aspects of it that they weren't aware of, maybe.
One of the project names that Clifford Stone says he's worked under were projects Moondust and Bluefly. And I mean, these are projects that actually were shown to exist, that there's documentation, so that Moondust and Project and Bluefly were real documents. So, well, what do you know about projects Moondust and Bluefly? And, you know, was your grandfather involved?
Just from the research I've looked at, you know, kind of briefly going through and what Clifford Stone's testimony was about. So Moondust was basically to gather all the intelligence about what the downed craft that were retrieved, gather anything that of significance, obviously, of alien nature, the technology, how it could possibly be used. And then Bluefly was to actually then disseminate that throughout the intelligence community. Within the private sector, within defense contractors, and slowly leak that out. It was basically, my grandfather didn't specifically speak on those projects, but he mentions Philip Corso and his book, The Day After Roswell, and of course, working with the Foreign Technology Division, getting all that, getting all those types of technology from, whether it was from Roswell or other crashes, and slowly leaking that out into the mainstream. That includes, you know, things like Velcro, lasers, fiber optics, the integrated circuit for computers. I mean, that's kind of how we went from vacuum tubes to, you know, these small computer chips in such a short amount of time. I think that had a big part of it. And so he does mention Philip Corso and his involvement, and the same as what Clifford Stone, I'm sure, was dealing with the technology. I would just say it too, on the compartmentalization, and even looking back at the records that we're seeing of where our grandfather's clearances were, what projects he was involved with. Well, early on, he even speaks of being involved with, even before the UFO topic, he says in his first official capacity was dealing with particleization. And since he was into these electronics early on, high powered radar, his testimony of his first encounter with a UFO was in, I think, 49. So right at the beginning of his career, and that was because he was testing these high-powered radar against SAC, you know, these kind of secret missions, and that's where the UFO sighting, when that happened, when they were told to basically gather all the pictures, all the radar images, and they just pretty much took them off, and they never heard of it again. They weren't to speak of it again. But our grandfather said he kept a copy and gave it to his crew and said, keep this for, you know, a keepsake for your family later. And I think that's where the image from the cover of his book comes from. But to go back to those programs, the particleization that he said he was involved with, again, he probably didn't have the whole picture, but if he's working on very classified things back at the very early stages, it just makes sense of how he would have developed in his career later. He claimed that he worked even under Benoit Mandelbrot and worked on the Mode 6 transponder, which was the first, you know, the black box that is in every aircraft now, how you how you were able to tell what happened to the craft, if it ever crashes, and the navigation system, all those things. So if he said he'd worked on that. And particleization is actually turning waves to particles or vice versa. It sounds very technical and high tech. So this is where what his testimony says, there's nothing officially to say that this was the program he was involved with, but he goes into great detail about it and what it is. And the fact that using our pineal gland, we are able to manifest, you know, and we're finding that out now, how that we're able to even create things our own consciousness, our own awareness. So if they knew this and were dealing with it back in the, say, even late 40s, early 50s, and probably tied into with other experiments, probably German technology as well. If the Germans had the down craft and had UFO tech, reverse engineered UFO technology already, he goes really into detail about that in the book. So he knew, and he had, I'm sure, access to many files that show this, laid those claims. And even the particleization had to do with the principles of time travel, you know, knowing the Nazi Bell happened, knowing that the Philadelphia experiment happened. I think these little components of technology were leaked in to the projects that he was working on himself. And again, he probably just had little pieces of access to that and later kind of saw more of where this was going. And that technology, by the way, he says it in the early in the book that it is tied to all the NSA types of post-hypnotic script and things that are YouTube satellites are able to actually infiltrate or get into your house to see what's going on within a square inch or whatever, down to that detail. But even he says into your own brain, into your own mind with that technology. So imagine if that's what they knew back then, what they're able to do now with that technology and mind control and, you know, manipulation, brainwashing, all that stuff. It's stuff that we talk about the UFO side of things, but there's a whole nother part of this and experiments that have been done and stuff that gets into, I think this is why this drip is happening, because of the experimentation that's taking place, the people involved, the criminal, very, very criminal things that have happened that there's no accountability for it. You know, for children being involved, for young people, for people being brainwashed, never knowing they're a part of the programs, all that has to come into play. So I know that's kind of on a tangent, but if he's saying he worked on those types of things early on, just imagine, you know, again, what they're really hiding and covering up at the end of the day. So,
yeah. And just to close the loop on, if it, you know, he didn't specifically say he was part of Project Moondust, but if the intent of that project was, you know, recovered ET crashes and things like that, you know, he was in the NRO, and he said his division was a scientific and technical unit of near-planetary phenomena. And Philip Corso actually also mentioned that unit as was formed in the late 40s to investigate UFOs, the first initial crashes that were documented with Roswell and a couple others. So, I mean, him claiming to be a part of that organization and that being associated with UFO crashes and investigating those things, it may have very, very well tied to the Moondust project.
Yes, as I understand it, you know, Project Moondust was finding the foreign technologies that had crashed worldwide. You have a team that goes there. Project Blue Fly was to retrieve that technology, take it back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for study, reverse engineering, technology distribution, as Corso said. And then you had the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit that would do the investigations. And I think there are majestic documents that show reports from the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit that was to investigate what happened, you know, give the specifics of the crash and give detailed reports for the intelligence community to understand it. So yeah, there were definitely different groups and organizations involved in a crash retrieval situation.
Yeah.
Okay, so one of the people that came forward in the 1990s is this Colonel Steve Wilson. And he says he was part of a Project Pounce, which is another name for a crash retrieval program. So do you know anything about Colonel Steve Wilson?
I actually had to do some digging and look at what his information was. I didn't have a whole lot of knowledge of his background and what he had, but it was very, very interesting when I started reading some of the documents and what he had to say, because from what we know, what our grandfather has said and the ties to these different projects, not only Project Pounce, but Project Grudge, Project Sign, Project Blue Book. Our grandfather mentions Project Bear, which I'm not sure if you've heard of Project Bear. I've never heard that anywhere either. But it goes in, Steve Wilson really goes into a lot of these details about Majestic 12, the origins, and how each of those, anything related to UFOs had to do with Magi projects, and basically majority committee or MJ-12 group had involvement and had access and dealings with all of those. And it, he mentions even ties to the NRO, how the security team was used, you know, the MIB security team with that, and a group called Delta, and even the Jason group. And I maybe we'll talk about this later about some other, you know, information we have about a grandfather that's come from other sources, but apparently tied to on the levels, again, the highest levels of Majestic 12 and this Jason Society and things like that starting to come to light. So I don't know, so many things popped out at me when I started reading about Steve Wilson and what he had to say.
Yeah, he's a very interesting whistleblower. And unfortunately, he died of cancer soon after coming forward. So that's something that has happened to quite a few whistleblowers. And you know, again, it just kind of shows that people who do come forward, they do have this, well, at least in the 90s and early 2000s, a lot of them did die of these different types of cancer that were very kind of fast moving. So, yeah.
We think that's but no accident at all. And that's, I think, also why our grandfather started to deteriorate when he did, because it was right as the disclosure project happened in 2001. So,
yes.
It makes sense.
Yeah. Well, there's another whistleblower, Command Sergeant Major Robert Dean, and he says that in 1964, he saw a cosmic top secret document called The Assessment that dealt with UFOs, a report on what NATO knew from all of these UFO sightings, interactions with the UFOs, knowledge of different extraterrestrials visiting planet Earth. And so that was the first time a lot of people had heard of cosmic top secret. And Robert Dean came forward and said that when in the 90s he came forward first talking about that. And no one knew that there was a cosmic top secret clearance in NATO, but then it was shown that, yes, it was. So I think the interesting thing here is that, okay, so we know there's a cosmic top secret clearance in NATO that is used, and your grandfather talked about life with the cosmos top secret. So are we talking about the same thing? Are these different classification levels? And did your grandfather know of Robert Dean?
I'm almost positive he knew of Robert Dean. I don't know, you know, him speaking of him in my experience personally, or he didn't really actually mention him in the book. But I think he's what Robert Dean had to share is so crucial. And those clearances obviously line up quite well from his information, from what I know, from what he had to say. And in the book, he mentions this about cosmos intelligence. He says, we refer to in cosmos intelligence Orion technology, that is ET technology 250 years ahead of us, like Star Wars. In the military, I learned we already made contact with at least four other planets in the universe. So that's more of his personal recollection of that clearance. And I think it ties in with what Robert Dean had to say about these other species involved, interactions involved too.
Well, recently there have been new whistleblowers who have come forward. David Grush is the most kind of well-known of those whistleblowers because of his testimony before the House Oversight Committee back in July of this year. And he discussed the intimidation of whistleblowers and witnesses. And he actually did say that people had been injured or killed. So that was kind of confirming what your grandfather said. So you want to talk about Rush and his testimony and what he had to say about whistleblowers, witnesses being intimidated, harassed, and even killed?
You go ahead, Dan. I'll let you start.
Oh, yeah. No, he claims that he was talked to several scientists that, said that their lives were threatened if they came forward. And one of the reasons he claims that he came forward himself was for his safety, because if he came out in public and something did happen to him later on, it would, be well documented or it'd be suspicious, we'll say. That's very interesting. I lost my train of thought where I was going with that. Sorry about that.
I'll expound on some of this. And my take is, I think David Grush is, like we kind of said earlier, Dr. Sala, that maybe there's obviously like a limited hangout happening within the disclosure movement. And I think Grush's testimony is very valid and it's very crucial to moving the goalpost forward in the right direction. So I think it's good. But I do think people need to be aware that this is just what he's allowed to say. I mean, if he's really been threatened, that's one thing, yes. But I think if he has to be very careful, obviously, the way how he states things and how he says things. And I think he's been groomed to say certain things a certain way. But also for his own safety, he's trying to be cautious. I just think he knows there's a lot more going on and a lot more that needs to be said. And that even goes back to this whole threatening thing and people getting killed. I just can tell you he's got to know more than he's sharing, or he's good at playing dumb and just trying to beat around the bush, because there's so much more going on under the surface of all this. And that goes back to what I was trying to say about, these experiments on people, military abduction, my lab cases, the U.S. and other governments trying to act as if they are the aliens abducting people and doing these very intrusive types of things and causing brainwashing, all sorts of things, all sorts of abuse, and then trying to basically hopefully wipe the mind of that individual so they don't even know they went through this traumatic event, though, of course, they're probably never the same. I just think there's so much more going on in the experimentation with the technology. Mind control, brainwashing is a huge part of it. That goes back to what the Nazis were doing. We brought in the UFO technology from the Nazis, obviously, with Project Paperclip. I think we brought in a lot more than that and a lot of kind of nefarious parts of what these programs are involved with. So until we really just blow the lid open on what's going on, we're going to get this drip of, okay, what can people handle right now? And, maybe that even goes into the spiritual aspect of things and how much it's going to upset the balance of, of religion and everything else.
And I do recall now where I was going with all that. Our grandfather, in our book, he talks about, Forrestal being suicided for wanting to come out with UFO information. He talks about Phil Schneider, who was a friend of his, and his demise after he came out, Bill Cooper also. So he was definitely aware of these things, and he definitely had some reluctance and some hesitation, as Dan Millis mentions to us at the Disclosure Project. When he actually was supposed to give his testimony, he kind of froze up on that. And I think that's because there was a lot of fear around coming forward with this information. I mean, some of the videos that we found of him kind of giving lectures was saying that, yeah, I'm here and my mission is to tell you what I know about anti-gravitational technology. And you come out and say that, and you're former ex-military person, I think people are going to notice that, who know who you are, and I think he feared a lot of what he was coming forward with, for sure.
Well, that takes us to a very interesting question, and that is David Grush and the other whistleblowers that have come forward and spoken to investigative journalists, they've talked about these crashed UFOs that have been retrieved and alien bodies that are in the possession of various corporations, and that they're being studied, and attempts at reverse engineering have failed, that they have been unsuccessful in reverse engineering the alien technologies. Now, I think that that's not true, but nevertheless, I think it's interesting that this group of whistleblowers that have that are coming forward now are saying that, as far as they know, none of these reverse engineering projects have been successful. So you mentioned your grandfather knew of or was involved in some of these anti-gravity technologies. So, you know, would he have agreed that these crashed UFOs had been successfully reverse engineered or not?
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's a lot of what he's talked about in videos we've heard, a lot of what he's talked about within his book, of course, that's specifically, you know, straight out says that. And one, for instance, was the Kalahari retrievals. There's a whole chapter on that. But he says that from that technology, from that down craft, we were able to basically make a lenticular vehicle that could park itself 600 miles outside into space. That's one instance. But all the German technology, that whole chapter on, you know, the Vril Society, the Black Sun, the secret societies, and how the Germany and the Third Reich basically were way ahead and did a lot with the Hanabu craft, the RFC craft. He names it specifically. He talks about Victor Schauberger and the implosion and how the technology worked, anti-gravity propulsion, and then also the more advanced you know, warp drive type of technology. There's so much involved in this. And he said in the Germans, by 1940, they could already, you know, park craft out in space, but they actually had motherships. One was called the Andromeda, or one was called the Atlantis, I think he says. And they could, you know, they could carry up to 7 Hanabu craft, the smaller craft. And basically space, this first space city, you know, I guess in modern times, was Peenemünde, where the Germans were launching not just rockets, but spaceships. And supposedly even before the end of World War II, Germany and Japan were successful in a one-way mission to Mars based on this technology. So,
And he talks about, pulse beam weapons being back engineered as well from downcraft, that the US was able to do that from the technology they retrieved.
Yeah, so that's very significant, because if you follow the testimony of David Grush and others, I mean, they say that, these UFO crashes happened as far back as 1933. That's the only one I can talk about. You know, there are earlier crashes, but David Grush, interestingly, he says that the crash in Italy in 1933 of a flying saucer craft, that was brought back to the United States. Well, that's 90 years ago. And of course, the information from Grush and other whistleblowers such as Bob Lazar and scientists like Dr. Eric Davis, they say that, we have these UFO technologies, but they haven't been reverse engineered. They're just too difficult to work out. So when you look at that, it's like, well, so they're saying that, yes, we've got UFO, we've retrieved UFO crash material going back to at least 1933. So that's 90 years. And in 90 years, our scientists have been unable to reverse engineer these technologies. I mean, is that a limited hangout or what?
Of course. Yeah. And why won't they ever talk about, I mean, you know, we know about things that happened with these treaties that were signed, but the actual human interaction, and our grandfather talks about that. There were actual live bodies, actually, you know, there weren't just, you know, the remnants of a craft and just pieces of body parts or anything. These were live beings that they found and were able to eventually communicate with after lots of trials, and the ability for them to use telepathy and affect their mind. And our grandfather talks about all of that stuff, the grays especially. But I mean, if they're live beings and we've been interacting with them, they've been one way or another trying to, you know, we've made deals where they're going to help us build these craft for, in exchange for what? In exchange for all that other stuff they don't want to talk about, you know, what they've been able to do with, you know, abducting humans and letting them take whatever they want from us or from cattle or whatever it might be. It's just a huge can of worms that they don't want to open up.
And the underlying reason, I mean, our grandfather mentions this too, is we're talking about technology that presents free energy. This makes everything else obsolete. Financially, the infrastructure of the whole planet would be changed, and there'd be a big collapse of what we currently have in place. And yeah, our grandfather mentioned that in his book. He mentioned it on some talks and some videos that we saw. But that's the whole reason for the secrecy in the first place. If there were alien craft and they existed, but we couldn't replicate the technology, then, you know, why would the government? I mean, the acknowledgement of UFOs wouldn't be such a big secret thing in my mind. But the fact that we have the technology and the fact that we have access to free energy is like, guys, this stuff exists, and that's why they're trying to cover it up. And these new whistleblowers who are, maybe they're either threatened with revealing that, or they're being given a script that they have to follow or something. Yeah.
Well, one of the Disclosure Project witnesses was a patent illustrator, Mark McCandlish, and he told a story about a fellow patent illustrator who was taken first to Norton Air Force Base and then ferried over to Edwards Air Force Base, where he went into a hangar and saw three UFOs, three fully intact flying saucers of different sizes, different capacities, that were being displayed to witnesses. So kind of like an air show, but here you have like a space show. So it was clear that these were vehicles that had been reverse engineered. He called it the alien reproduction vehicle. So it was clear, and this incident happened, as I recall, in 1988. So in 1988, they had fully functional flying saucer craft that were alien reproduction vehicles. These had been successfully reverse engineered. They were being sold to different customers, and I'm assuming the different customers would have been like the Air Force Secret Space Program, the Navy Secret Space Program, the CIA, the NRO, and they would have been the customers, and they were being shown off. And you also had a cutaway of one of the UFOs that was on display there. So did your grandfather ever say anything about Mark McCandlish and what he knew of these UFOs that were on display, or these flying saucers on display at this air show?
Yeah, so I mean, this was again part of the Disclosure Project whistleblower testimony, and Mark McCandlish. So this was in the book as well, in grandfather's book. What he knew beforehand, I'm not sure, but I think from that press club hearing, and probably meeting Mark in person, I'm sure maybe connected a lot of dots of things that he might have already known about these reproduction vehicles. And that blew my mind when I saw Mark McCandlish and these diagrams and things, the detail that he had of all this and how the technology worked in 2001. That blew my mind, and I was like, this is it. This is what we needed to see. Now there's no stopping it. It'll blow the lid open on everything. We should have free energy within a few years. And that was in 2001. I was just very optimistic, you know, seeing that. And I was just hoping, based on what he had to say, because he was so smart and so obviously technical about all this and how it works. So I was like, wow, we really have a hold on what we can do with this. And of course, nothing happened after that. And sadly, Mark McCandlish, you know, died within the last few years. And it doesn't seem like it was just by natural means. I think there was something there. I think he was definitely suicided in some shape or form, unfortunately.
And when you think about the Disclosure Project in 2001 and all the testimonies that came out, Mark McCandlish and everyone else, I mean, all the detailed information that they provided, and it just kind of went under the radar for so long. And now these new whistleblowers are coming out because it almost shows you how the government is trying to present a narrative, one that they agree with and they want to push on you. And they didn't like the disclosure narrative, because 2001 Disclosure Project narrative, because it just they laid everything out. I mean, it was massive and intense. And this now that the next round of it's coming up with these new whistleblowers, it's very much, you can tell it's controlled, and it's
well. Just to add that to that, I mean, this has to be obvious to everybody. When Dr. Greer had his summer release of these like four or five major whistleblowers testimony, guess what happened just within the same week? David Grush comes out with all this information, and he's been headline news ever since. What happened to those whistleblowers that just came out with this, you know, breakthrough, you know, all this testimony that's coming out, even more so, and even has to do with human trafficking, things like that. Of course, you don't want to hear that. Many things that are amazing in itself. Each one had such a great story to tell. I mean, of what they knew firsthand, experienced, and that's just never been talked about. So it's obvious to me, you know, David Grush is front and center for a reason, and they put him out just at the perfect timing, again, to swipe the other stuff under the rug and keep people from. Mm-hmm.
That there is a limited hangout happening. It's interesting that Bob Lazar has come out and told his story. A book has been published about him. He's been covered prominently by Jeremy Corbell and George Knapp. And Bob Lazar's story is well known, but he says essentially that the UFO craft or the flying saucer craft that he saw at S4 facility in Area 51 back in 1988 and 89, that he says that the technologies were too advanced, that they couldn't work them out. And it's interesting that Jeremy Corbell and George Knapp, that they are covering extensively testimonies of Bob Lazar, David Grush. And again, it's all predicated on this new narrative that, yes, these craft have been retrieved, they are being studied, they do involve extraterrestrial intelligence, but we haven't been able to reverse engineer it. It's too complicated for us yet. And of course, Dr. Stephen Greer's whistleblowers are putting out a different narrative, and they've been sidelined. So yes, I agree with that. And you want to say anything about Bob Lazar's story, it kind of coming out again at this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it came out when it did for a reason, and he was allowed to say what he had to say for a reason, but he didn't have the whole story of everything, obviously, at that time. And so for it to come out again, it's just kind of to put it in people's face to say, this is all we have, this is all the real testimony we have. And so let's re-investigate that or bring it back to the public view. But everything else, let's just disregard altogether. There's nobody else that has a valid testimony to share. It's like, of course, it's BS. So, I think Bob Lazar's testimony, again, was advantageous. It was helpful in a way to get people to start looking at this more seriously, one way or another. But it's obvious it's a limited hangout. There's so much more we need to be talking about. And we're just barely scratching the surface to say, is there intelligent life in the universe? And to that point, our grandfather said this, and I think he quoted maybe even John Mack in the book, that, no other culture in the history no other civilization in the history of our known civilization, of known humanity, has ever said that we are the only intelligent species in the universe. I mean, every other civilization in our past has claimed that, there is advanced life out there. We've been contacted with them. We come from the stars, like all these ancient texts, all these things, all this evidence. But why is it that our intelligence, our scientific community, and our mainstream narrative has to be, we are the end all and be all, and it's taking us so long to change our paradigm and shift away from that. And so that just shows you what kind of brainwashing we've all succumbed to over the last, it's been generations that we've all been through this. And our grandfather knew it, and he was on the front lines of trying to get that out. So,
Yeah, it is very interesting where we stand at the moment with the U.S. Congress coming out now with this UAP records collection that's going to be established, which is kind of like what remains of what was originally a much more broader, comprehensive UAP Disclosure Act. Now they're just going to create these records. And, the Congress is now looking at these testimonies. But it's interesting that they're only looking at the testimonies of people that are saying that these UFOs have been recovered, are being studied in classified facilities, but no success. But they're not looking at people who have come forward to say that, yes, I've actually served in a covert program aboard one of these spacecraft. I mean, you had Michael Herrera from the Stephen Greer's recent disclosure project press conference. You've also got a person I'm working with who's currently U.S. Army, who's been on multiple craft and actually has photos. We actually have photos. He's taken photos of the craft and was asked, mm-hmm. told to take photos of the craft by covert Air Force personnel. But no one's asked about him. You know, it seems that right now the press and major investigators like Corbell and George Knapp and others, you know, they're just interested in those people who have solid credentials that can prove that, yes, you know, we served for so many years in the military and we know of this program, but they're not interested in people with actual experience on these secret space programs. So, you know, why is that?
It doesn't match their narrative, you know? And I think it does come back to if we had proof that we were able to reverse engineer this technology, it would change the world forever. And you know, it would collapse economies and, you know, that they lose their power, right?
Yeah, that's the point Stephen Greer makes. And I think he's absolutely correct. I mean, Stephen Greer, he definitely is someone that brought forward some incredible whistleblowers back in 2001. And he's definitely breaking the narrative of the kind of like this controlled opposition that we are witnessing, or this limited hangout that is being rolled out. Well, I want to move over to this organization within the National Security Agency called ACIO, the Advanced Contact Intelligence Organization. So your grandfather talked about it in his book, Life with the Cosmos Top Secrets. So, yeah, you want to tell us any new information you've gotten about that?
Yeah, I can start, I guess. Yeah. So he did mention the ACIO in his book, Alien Contact Intelligence Organization, or Advanced Contact Intelligence Organization. He's the only one of the whistleblowers from the Disclosure Project to mention it. He said, you know, when you're there's a secret organization called the NRO that he was involved with, and it was obviously secretive until 97 or whatever it is. And he said, if you're on that level, and if you have access on that level, there's another organization called the ACIO. And if you pay your dues, he said specifically, if you pay your dues and you follow the rules, your government will be able to take advantage of that organization's information, basically have access to that. So we've tried to do some more digging. There's an interesting document basically that he references in the last chapter, the Wingmakers chapter. And that document, it was only like one page, but it actually is about 10 pages. And I have the printout from the original, from the actual website, the Wingmakers website, where it came from. And he had that full document from the very beginning. And we went over that because it actually interestingly covers a prediction of 2023 and where we're headed. And here we are, 2023. I thought it was interesting. I found it over the summer, and I said this should be something we talk about. But it did mention that by this time we would basically have an easier, it'd be almost like we have a means of connecting there to a galactic internet. Basically, our internet would be so, you know, involved all over the world. People would have access to it, but we'd obviously have some other connection, even interstellar, and with other, you know, beings, advanced races that are already here trying to communicate one way or another, and just trying to tell us that we're going to be so tapped in and connected by this year. And I think we're seeing that, you know, we're seeing that in a lot of levels with the disclosure coming out. So that was interesting.
Yeah. And we weren't sure if we were going to talk about this much or not, but, you know, other, we have other information coming from people who are claiming to be a part of the ACIO and independent secret space program individual affirming that our grandfather had involvement with the ACIO in some way, shape, or form. So that's very interesting. We're still investigating that and trying to learn more before we kind of disclose more of that. But yeah, it's certainly very interesting that he was the only one in the Disclosure Project to mention the ACIO, and then these two sources are saying that he was involved with it. So yeah,
very interesting organization. I remember reading the Wingmakers material, and it talked about some brain enhancement technology that was used by the ACIO, that if you wanted to join and rise through the ranks, you had to go through this. So if you had, if you joined and you had, say, an IQ of 160 or 170, which is already kind of, you're looking at a genius level, it would be boosted, you know, by 30 points or so to 200 or whatever. And this was the standard protocol, because you needed that kind of level of IQ to be able to interact with extraterrestrials. So, yeah, what do you know about that?
That basically, yeah, that I remember reading that. And if you go to the Wingmaker's site, it Dr. Neruda was supposedly the defector who got all this information out and started that website with the material that he felt he had to share, because he knew they wouldn't get out otherwise. So he defected, and he did so with a lot of reluctance, because they have even the technology not just to enhance your intelligence, but also to wipe your brain, to wipe your mind completely of everything you know. And that's part of what blank slate technology is and what BST technology is. So he said he had to get out as soon as he could and however he could before they tried to wipe his mind. And he knew that's what they were going to do when they caught wind of that he was thinking of defecting, or likely could defect, but supposedly that was the story. So yeah, for sure they have that technology, not only to enhance your mind, but to completely wipe your mind. And if we listen to some of these secret space program testimonies, that's a huge part of the story, is that most people don't know that they ever were involved in the first place. And it's because this technology can wipe you completely. If there's a 20 and back, that's potentially possible. And so many, like Tony Rodriguez, have come out and said this. And it's really hard to after what he has and all the evidence he has for this happening, that you can try to debunk his story. It's amazing. But there's many like him saying this, and he happened to be one of the few that could remember. But if there's thousands of us involved, then no wonder, you know, if they have the technology to wipe your mind, it's not being told. It's not. And nobody knows who to believe, because, you know, you've got pieces and fragments that seem like a dream, or, you know, just some random thing. But how can you put those pieces together when it's not even in linear time with the, when it comes to these programs and the 20 and back programs? So it's very complex and complicated. We actually, those same sources that claimed our grandfather's a part of the ACIO claimed that he was trained at early stages and gone through these programs to interact with ETs in some level. And that was part of one of the levels of training that he got to, and how to interact. And that was very interesting to hear. And then even if me and my brother might be involved at some level, we've also, you know, there could be those aspects we're trying to explore and find out, because, again, we don't have a knowing of that, you know. But if they can do these procedures, wipe your mind of it, then who knows what's really happening. So we're really investigating much more, as you can probably imagine.
I know you have a show on the Infinite Channel. So you want to tell us about your show and what you do and how people can subscribe and all of that?
Yeah. So we're on Infinite TV, infinite.tv, and Infinite is spelled INFYNIT.TV. And our show is called Shred the Veil. And the purpose of the show is just for us to continue on to our grandfather's legacy. And he was a very big advocate of making sure that people knew about this information. And it was, he says that in his book. I mean, it's vitally important. That was his mission. He was very passionate about it, putting the information out there and making sure that humanity has an opportunity to wake up to the truth. So we, inspired by that, we do interviews with various people in the disclosure realm, and explore other topics as well. But yeah, the intent of shredding the veil of the narrative that we've been stuck with for forever now. And we're also doing our own YouTube channel. It's CLR Thought. It's clear, logical, rational thought is the theme of it. It's just a similar idea. Just, you know, we're trying to expose some things that we can present to people that they may not have heard of, and we're not trying to persuade anyone of anything, but let them make their own decisions after we present the information to them. So.
I was just going to say before we close out, there was just a couple of like anecdotes or personal stories that are that we know from our grandfather's past. Actually, one came from our father not too long ago. We had no idea this happened to him, but it's a personal account he had. And by the way, before I get to that, our mom and our stepmom, actually, our grandfather was married to a Japanese woman who, you know, that's our mom's half Japanese. So there's a whole story behind his journey to Japan, coming back to the U.S., almost getting court-martialed for kidnapping my mom and his supposed wife, or, you know, from Japan. But that's a whole nother story. But our mom and our step-grandma, the one that raised our mom, they both worked at NASA, by the way, during the moon landing. And, you know, my mom just said, well, your grandma had a, you know, worked for the government, so she had access to that. But it's just kind of very coincidental that they would be working in a place like that at that time. And if our grandfather had anything to do with that, we don't know, but it's interesting to note. And this was from our dad just recently. He said that, well, there was a van that he inherited from our grandfather. He called it like the boogie van, because it was just this ugly brown colored big size van with plush like captain chairs that swiveled inside and all this stuff. But anyway, he told this story after we started talking to you, Dr. Sala, and revealing this. He said, well, this was interesting because he worked as an engineer, and he would have to go as a contractor to certain sites. And one happened to be the naval base in Norfolk. And he says, this is what he said from the text. He said, you know, this van, you know, had a big full size van with plush captain chairs that swiveled. Perhaps you remember it. And of course we remember that. He says it's the one I famously de-backed into a light pole at some later time. He said, anyway, I got to the guardhouse. This is at Norfolk, expecting to spend 10 or 15 minutes describing who I was and where I was going. But lo and behold, they waved me right through. I looked at them quizzically like, are you sure? You know, this was baffling as to him, because all the people told him it'd take an act of God to get into this naval base. Like, they would just be like, you know, questioning him and wanting his ID. They never asked for his ID. They waved him through. So he was stunned. But when he left, he went by the guardhouse and said, you know, why did you wave me through? And the guard said, it's because of the license plate. And that's basically all he said. And my dad doesn't remember what the license plate was, but remember we talked about his going away president from the NRO was that Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit license plate. So maybe it was that exact one, or it was something that had some type of symbol or that allowed him to get right on the base. So.
But yeah, they acknowledged our grandfather's van and just like waving right through. That's like, crazy. Yeah.
Amazing. I'm sure your grandfather's watching from the other side and is probably very proud of what you're both doing to continue his legacy of disclosure. So I think the information you've been presenting is very important. And I'm glad that you're continuing to pursue the truth and finding documents and revealing everything you find. So thank you for all your efforts.
Yeah, and thank you so much for the opportunity to share this with your audience. We really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
And we recommend that you visit their website, Infinity TV, and there is a website link I'll put in the description for this interview for you to visit their show. So thank you again.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.